there's another. I had a quiz or something for you right up here. Okay, so remember what happens? We go through, what is today? Thursday? Tuesday? Right. Okay, one of those. Then we actually, next week, we start this the exams. And what's on this exam? Is it all multiple choice? No, because we're going to have it in the lab, so we have more time for you to answer some open response questions. So there's some blanks there. We don't want to see blanks as answers, right? We want some information, guess if you want, right? You know, whatever you want, like the sun is shining today or something. All right, but, you know, try to think about what the answer might be. Some of the multiple choice might help you, but again, it's not like guessing, right? In the sense of A, B, and C. Maybe we'll just write C on there. That won't get it either. But, okay, so try to answer the questions. Think through it. Even on your multiple choice, we have some students come by and look at old exams. And, you know, they just want to know the answers. So we're not just giving you the answer. You have to work through it. So we don't have answers for all the test banks. But as soon as they would work through and drawing it out, then they would get the right answer, right? Or sometimes by process of elimination. So even on multiple choice exams, you know, if you draw it out or draw the diagram of sarcomere, for example, then you can really get down to answering the question pretty much yourself. But drawings really help a lot. Any questions about that? No? Yes? So what is today? Today is Thursday, isn't it? Yes? Tuesday. It's Tuesday. Yes, that's right. Tuesday. Thanks. Okay, so it is Tuesday. So what we finish covering on Thursday, then that'll be the end for the exam. So we're going to kind of go through endocrine quickly. We'll go through the beginning of cardiovascular. We won't get through it all. And then we're going to stop at that point for the exam. If I ask questions on the exam that are beyond Thursday, remind me. You know, count that off, but I'll try to make sure I haven't written the exam yet. Take some time to make four different exams, different kind of questions. So Monday's class can't really tell too much to Tuesday. And Tuesday can't tell too much to Wednesday. Just say to the next partner that asks, how was the exam? Just say it was miserably horrible, study all night, you know, something like that. Okay? Okay, so this is where we are. And let's go through some of this. Okay, so this is kind of a fun refreshing aspect on endocrine disruption. And some of these points, I think you can take home some of this and say, oh, endocrine's really important. I didn't realize how much this affects development, function, physiology. And remember, there is a whole field out there in endocrinology, endocrinologist. There's even journals just in comparative endocrinology. So if you're interested in comparative aspects, there's a whole field in that as well. So there's a lot out there in endocrine. And when you think about it, it's really very integrative to the whole body. Quite interesting. So let's just look through some of these aspects and then think about the problems that could exist. What if you had increased growth hormone? What does it do? Increases growth, right? And anybody remember, is this a generation gap? The Munsters? Remember the Munsters? Right? Lurch and all that? So, you know, gigantism, right? Who was the basketball player that was in China that was... Yeah, you know, gigantism, problems like this. So you can imagine if this happens before puberty, then your bones can grow really well, right? And you can become quite large. But what happens after puberty when your epiphyseal plates close and your bones, they can't elongate anymore, right? And your bone structure is pretty much set. But you still have growth hormone releasing, so then your organs start to grow, and then you get acromegaly. And acromegaly is a problem, too, because think of the heart growing inside of this closed chamber, or the rest of your body and bones growing. So it's really quite a problem. And you don't have, this is a good point I put in red, and this can help you on some standardized exams. I've seen it sometimes on Kaplan exam test banks. Tumors usually are over-secreting, and they do not respond to negative feedback. So sometimes there's been tricky questions on standardized exams with that and the endocrine part. So just remember, no negative feedback with some of these tumors. So they won't respond to the higher concentration of whatever it might be that would give a negative feedback. Okay, so you can kind of see the problems with acromegaly, the progression of acromegaly. That can be quite severe. You can see how a person can change quite quickly with increased growth hormone. And the way they remove these, they used to go through the palate through the mouth and go up to the pituitary and remove that. Now they go through the nose and they can remove the pituitary that way. It's kind of an interesting aspect. So this happens. It might be kind of gross that you think about it now. Maybe in the future there'll be better ways to deal with this, but this is still one approach that goes across the street. People still get this done. But you can imagine, what happens if you remove the pituitary gland? What's in the pituitary? What's in the anterior pituitary? What hormones? FSH, LH. We're in trouble. Okay, and then the posterior pituitary, oxytocin, vasopressin, right? You remove all that, think about what's happening to the body. Wow, right? And so they end up in a real delicate balance to try to keep their body going and functioning when they remove these pituitary glands. And there's lots of swings, lots of behavioral aspects that go along with this too. And it can be quite debilitating, but got to get the tumor out. And some of it is with drugs that can work on it as well. So you can imagine they have to go through and do this. Quite an amazing adventure. They do try some drugs to help with therapy. You don't have to memorize these drugs, but I just put those out there in case you're taking a pharmacology course, for example, which I really recommend. A pharmacology course is great. You learn a lot of physiology in it. Okay, and we'll just skip some of this. But here's kind of an interesting question. We didn't cover this content yet, but we will. Somatomedins. Insulin-like growth factor, these actually help stimulate growth. And this is responsive to growth hormone. So this could be from a particular tissue and then released, I don't want to go into too many details about it, released in the response to growth hormone. And so you can think about if you had a tumor, let's say, for example, and I pulled this question out because it was on a test bank before. Not my test bank, one of those Kaplan or dental test banks. And so just to kind of think about it, if you had too much growth hormone, what would happen? So usually they can test this by giving a glucose surge. Remember we talked about glucose? Growth hormone raises your glucose. So if your glucose was high, then you should expect a decrease in growth hormone, right? So they could do a glucose challenge. You might have heard somebody doing this for a diabetic, for example, to see how well they can regulate their glucose. But if you had a tumor, it wouldn't respond, right? Because we just said tumors don't show this negative feedback process. So I know this could be a little bit confusing, but then you think about if you had kept secreting growth hormone, then what would happen? And this is a factor that is responsive to growth hormone, and so that's really your answer, because you wouldn't see the decrease in glucose with the glucose challenge or the decrease in growth hormone, because of the lack of negative feedback. So I've kind of put this on the web, on your PowerPoints. You can read through some of that. But it's the same idea with the other hormones. No negative feedback if there's a tumor in that particular region. So think about the opposite. What if the pituitary gland wasn't functioning? It didn't develop right. Now you have too low of all those hormones. Wow. And there's a lot of hormones, right? So it's not that common, but it happens. But think about too low of amount of those hormones in development, for example. The follicular stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone, growth hormone, vasopressin, oxytocin. So you can think of all the problems that would occur if you had too low of a level. All right. So just think about those hormones too. So this is you back to your note cards, right, that you've made for endocrine, hopefully. And then you can think about, well, if I had too low, if this is what it does, what if it was too low, right? And so you can think about those problems. These are extra comments. These came out of teaching some nursing class work. And if you had inappropriate antidiuretic hormone, so an overproduction of antidiuretic hormone, right? Anti-urine formation, right? Antidiuretic hormone, what would happen if you're not getting rid of that? Then it's building up, right? You're building up that fluid because it's the antidiuresis. So if you had too much of it, you can imagine the problems that would happen with osmolarity and water balance in your body. Remember, hyponatremia is life-threatening. You drink too much water, right? You dilute your salts. That can be life-threatening too. So you can imagine this is an issue. Okay, so just kind of going through that. Let's We don't have to go through the causes and things like that, but you can imagine a lot of these problems like inflammation, viral infection, things like that can hit these regions and actually cause problems, even with the thyroid gland, for example. We'll get to that. So diabetes, usually when we talk about diabetes, we think about diabetes mellitus with sugar, but there's also diabetes insipidus, which is the lack of production of ADH or vasopressin, or maybe even the lack of the response. The receptors aren't there. So what would happen if you didn't make ADH, right? Antidiuretic hormone. So then your problems with fluid balance again and electrolytes. So, and then going to the bathroom all the time, right? Antidiuresis. So if you didn't have the antidiuretic hormone, then you make too much urine production. Okay. So if we get to thyroid, remember we talked about T3 and T4 with the thyroid, with the iodine, three iodines or four iodines, and that's why we call it T3 or T4, and metabolism and growth. We've talked about hypermetabolism, hypermetabolic rates, for example, and people used to be kind of a fad there for a while, and then they got kind of more careful with it, about removing part of the thyroid gland to decrease people's hypermetabolism. But you can imagine if you had a tumor and it was overproducing that or underproducing it, what would happen? So if you didn't have iodine, for example, in your salt, in your diet, and this is why we talked about iodized salt, right? That you have iodized salt to help make thyroid. But you could have it from other regions. Like if you had a tumor in your anterior pituitary and you were producing too much thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH, right? And that would cause the thyroid to enlarge. Or if you didn't have the iodine in your diet. So where is the problem? Is it in the hypothalamus, that then the thyroid-releasing hormone? Is it in the anterior pituitary, thyroid-stimulating hormone? Or is it in the thyroid gland itself, right? So it's kind of interesting to figure that out and to experiment and try to find out where the problem might be. And they can measure the levels of thyroid-releasing hormone, thyroid-stimulating hormone, thyroid hormones themselves, and figure that out by measurements today in the blood. So it's kind of interesting. All right. And so as we mentioned, they can test it with blood samples and actually look for it. People get thyroiditis, like an inflammation. Sometimes if it's chronic, it's called a Hashimoto's disease. NL is like normal tissue. So you can imagine the problems. Again, something can happen just acutely in you, for example, if you had a viral infection or a bacterial infection, and then you could have these problems of hypermetabolism, so they need to investigate why the problem might arise. I know some of these pictures are gross, but I just because we had them. Remember, if you had hyperthyroidism or removal of the thyroid, remember what else is related with the thyroid? Parathyroid, right? And what does parathyroid do? If we injected you with parathyroid, what would happen to your... What would you want to think about? What comes to your mind right away? Parathyroid. Calcium. What's going to happen to calcium? Is it going to go up in your blood or is it going to go down in your blood? Go up, right? And what's the antagonistic type of hormone? Calcitonin, because tone in the bone, right? Tone in the bone. Calcium goes into the bone. And so that would lower it. Now, there's some subtle differences on things, but the general point, that's the main thing. I think we mentioned to somebody about there was actually a drug company that was making parathyroid hormone for people with parathyroid, lack of parathyroid, and the company was actually saying, we're not going to produce this anymore because it's not cost effective for us, and it went all the way to Congress to actually force that company to continue to make it because they were just interested in money. And so they actually had to keep making it. So some of this is, you know, very important, right? These drug companies and the compounds they make, and this was one company that was producing it. So you think of going all the way to Congress to force a company to continue to make these compounds because people's lives were really dependent on it. So it's kind of interesting when you put it all together. Graves' disease, another problem, excessive thyroid hormone. So what would happen if you had, you know, too much? It's like what we just talked about. Look at this tumor. Then you can imagine metabolism problems, glucose regulation problems, lots of problems. And some of this is actually, they get this exophthalmic region because fat bodies build up behind the eye, so the eye kind of protrudes out. So that's one of the characteristic signs that they can look for. We'll skip through some of this. All right. Hypothyroidism, if it was too low, you can imagine the problems with that too. And so this is actually, if it happens during development, because we told you about thyroid being very important for development, right? Muscle differentiation, fast and slow muscle, also comparative aspects, very important for amphibians, reptiles, birds. If an amphibian doesn't have the right thyroid hormone, for example, their tail doesn't regress, they don't form their legs, if it's like going from a tadpole to a frog. So very important in development. And so if you had this as a infant and you didn't make the thyroid hormone, then you get this disease called creatinism. So it used to be kind of confused with dwarfism. It's not the same as dwarfism. Creatinine is really a problem too, creatinism. Low stature, you can see it's only four feet high. And it could have been averted with treatment. Now they actually test children, babies that are born, infants, for thyroid problems or other problems. But some, your own choice, people's own choices, but some people choose not to have their children tested for these endocrine problems. And then those children end up with these problems, but they think just the way it should be. Kind of crazy in my view, but everybody has their own personal views, that's fine. And also with creams that they might put in their eye to avoid eye infections and blindness, but some people vote not to have that. They actually tell them not to have those tests done or the creams in their eyes. It has stopped child blindness, but some people still choose not to do that, and that's their choice, I guess. I think in time, those children might grow up and think of child abuse, but anyways, that's their choice. So some problems with these things. So if you had, let's go back to this, hypothyroidism, you end up with some really interesting aspects that can happen, muscle weakness like we talked about, and you get these kind of red patches. You might have seen people with some of that when they get older. Myxoedema, problems with the skin. And so these are kind of cases that a dermatologist might pick up and then realize that they need to be checked up for internal medicine kind of checkups. There's a lot of diseases that like dermatologists actually catch and then they follow up on it because there's a lot of skin manifestations, even blood pressure or dehydration or a lot of these issues with particular endocrine disruptions, and they actually pick it up on the skin and then follow up on that and find out what it is. It's kind of interesting. Okay, so adrenal cortex. What does the adrenal cortex do? Two major hormones or aspects we should think about. Adrenal cortex. Cortex, around the cortex, around the adrenal gland. Mineralocorticoids and the other corticoids. Glucocorticoids, right? Cortisol. So mineralocorticoids and glucocorticoids. Mineralocorticoids means, think of the kidney, aldosterone, right? Sodium resorption, water balance, blood pressure. Glucocorticoids, think of cortisol, stress hormones, glucose regulation, right? So what would happen if you had a disorder with that and it was too much or too low? Then you can think about, this is going to happen, right? So we can go through some of that. Cushing syndrome is really something interesting. You might have seen people with this, and they can get checked up, but there's classic symptoms with this. The swelling, increase in muscle weakness, but increase in fat as well that could build up. Cushing syndrome. So they get these stretch, kind of like stretch marks on the belly. Pigmentation, that's a classic too. Problems of Cushing disease, you think of the muscles breaking down, but then building up fat, that's a problem. Look at the problems that can happen with children, for example. Real a problem, gain quite a bit of weight. 3 pound weight gain in one day. Wow. Bad news, right? So lots of issues with this kind of thing. And then the immune system that's related with it as well. So they could go in and remove part of it, or treatment, or try to destroy part of that tumor if it's overproducing. Now there's drugs that they use. If you didn't have enough production in your adrenal cortex, you get a disease called Addison's disease. And JF had that, Kennedy. So that was an issue for him at the time, but he got through it, so it's kind of interesting. Some problems that can happen with this too. And so you don't have to know all the details. We just put this up there. Just think of the major points that we've covered in these aspects. All right. So some of the problems with if you have steroids, right? And you hear about athletes shooting up steroids, not just testosterone, but cortisol and other steroids. Or if you have some kind of inflammation, you might get corticosteroid injections. So what would happen to your adrenal cortex if you took exogenous cortisol? For example, maybe joint pains and things like that. Is it going to get larger? Is it going to secrete more cortisol? Is it going to secrete less cortisol? It's going to secrete less, right? So now you keep getting these cortisol injections for whatever reason it might be. Might have joint pains, or sometimes allergists give it to for an allergy response. What if you chronically kept taking that all the time, right? What's going to happen to your adrenal cortex? It's smaller and smaller. It's not going to secrete as much. And then you come off cold turkey. And now you have a stressful situation and you need that glucose. You can't produce it, right? So you've got a problem. And this is the problem with people that are on chronic cortisol treatments. And that can happen. So they tell them to come off very carefully because it could be even life-threatening. So very interesting to think about. Okay, so I know that was fast and furious. And you're probably like, oh my God, there's so much to memorize. No, there really wasn't. There's the same stuff that we've went over already in the endocrine on the main takeovers. Okay, but it was hopefully to help pull it together to see the effects on humans. But not only that, if you're interested in veterinarian care, like some of our students are, you think about all that is related with animals, people's pets, farm animals, your food supply, things like that too. So they watch out for all these kind of problems. Okay. Was that enough for you to kind of digest? Hopefully fast and furious. All right. But kind of go through there, and you might find those of interest for you later on if you're going into allied health or other aspects, or you take a pharmacology course. Hopefully some of those slides can help you to refresh you a bit. Some of those slides, the content was put in there because of going through a Kaplan test bank before, too. So if you're taking Kaplan test or standardized exams, you might want to look through that to really nail down the endocrine. If you take... Did some of you have 412G yet, human physiology? No? Yes? Maybe? No one remembers it. It was too traumatic. Okay. They probably cover quite a bit of the endocrine processes, but what we've had over the years, the students say they don't really talk about the disease state so much. So in case you do take that, this might help you as well to help understand some of the content. Okay, circulatory system. Rethink now. All those hormones, where do they travel through? Blood supply, right? So why do we need the circulatory system? To get all those great endocrine compounds that we just talked about to the tissues, right? What's another factor for mammals with the circulatory system? What should we think about? Why do we need a blood supply? Just think, general, right? Oxygen delivery to the tissues, which is carried in red blood cells and hemoglobin, right? And what else? So we'd have down the tissue, metabolizing, you're exercising your muscle, what is it producing as a byproduct? Byproduct of glucose? Who's got the tattoo yet? 10 extra points, no, I'm joking. C6, H12, O6 plus 6 oxygens, goes to? CO2 and metabolic water, right? And then you can get your ATP and heat production as well if you want to continue with that whole thing. So we got to get rid of the CO2, right? So what happens if CO2 builds up in your blood? What happens to your pH? It drops, right? pH goes down. Remember that people still get confused on the pH. I know even at this stage in careers and stuff, you kind of like sometimes forget about that. A high hydrogen ion is a low pH, right? Okay, so... What about if we talked about invertebrates with the circulatory system, like your one of your favorite animals, a crayfish? Does it use the blood supply, which we now call hemolymph, because they have an open circulatory system, so blood hemolymph, kind of analogous, but an open circulatory system. Is it still used for hormone transport? Is it still used to probably get oxygenation and CO2 exchange? Right? Now, think about insects. When we think about insects, the thing that's taken in entomology, how does oxygenation get down to the tissues in insects? And I know we didn't cover it yet here, but just to get you on the same line, you know, level. Insects use trachea, and that's really getting oxygenation right down to tissue. So not so much by blood carrying the oxygen. We'll get to that point when we get into respiratory. But they have trachea that branch right on down. If you dissected the fruit flies in your genetics class, did anybody dissect fruit flies? You know, when you tore them up, you might have saw a lot of guts and stuff, but those little silvery kind of tubes that were running down the back of the larvae, for example, those are trachea, and they branch right down into the tissue, right down into the muscle, and that's the oxygenation and gas exchange. And they go right into the brain, and that's for the gas exchange. So blood's not so, or hemolymph is not so much for gas exchange in insects, more so the tracheal system. Okay, so some of that. What else could we think about circulatory system? What else does it do for us? Think if you had an open response question, you had to answer all these, you know, like lots of different points that the circulatory system does for you. Anything else besides hormones, gas exchange, homeotherms like you, hint, hint. Any even ectotherms, hint, hint. Why are we going therms? What's related to this term? Body heat, right? Temperature regulation. Really important for temperature regulation, all right? Cold day like today, right? You're trying to keep your body warm. Your hands out, and the cold might have actually vasoconstricted to kind of not get that cold going through your bloodstream, right? Because you want to keep your body core temperature regulated. So you actually close off blood vessels to your hands and peripheral tissue to try to maintain body temperature so you don't cool off. But if you're overheated, what happens? Start to sweat, right? Your palms will sweat, your feet will sweat, your soles of your feet will sweat to regulate body temperature. So body temperature is very important in the circulatory system as well. Anything else you can think of? All right, we'll go through this and hopefully some things will... But I'm just trying to get you to think big picture too. So big picture first, and then we work down to the nitty-gritty details. Okay. So the circulatory system is amazing in a comparative aspect because you can go from simple organisms to more complex organisms. I mean, at one time in the Field Museum in Chicago, if you ever go to Chicago, go to the Field Museum. Fantastic, of course, the dinosaur zoo is there, the T-Rex, right? When you walk in, just phenomenal. But they used to have an exhibit of I think it was a sperm whale heart, and you could actually, or blue whale heart, and right when you went in, and you could kind of walk through the different chambers. The size of a whale heart, the size of a VW bug, the Volkswagen bug. Think about that. God. You know, a Volkswagen bug. And you can actually crawl through the aorta, and out the pulmonary artery. I mean, it's so cool. You see this big thing, and my kids were like, Dad, stop that. But it's so fun to go see this gigantic heart, the size of a Volkswagen bug. Can you imagine? Think of how thick that tissue is and how it works. They have arrhythmias or... You know, what's going on? How does it supply that thick of tissue? And they actually have an EKG of a whale heart beating when they actually shot some harpoons into it a long time ago and they recorded an EKG. Now they can work with, like, the killer whales, which aren't really whales, but the orcas, that are, you know, in, like, SeaWorld and stuff. And they've got a lot of physiology on these animals now, too, which is quite interesting. But the size of the differences in the circulatory system among animals, from a whale to us to a little fruit fly larvae, you know, a little heart tube, or your crayfish. Just think about that. It's an amazing system. And how it develops and forms right, there are a lot. At the end of this chapter, we go through a lot of disorders, and there are quite a number of disorders in humans and animals in the forming of mammals, for like veterinarians, in the development of the heart, and arrhythmias are not forming right, are actually defects that can cause a child to die at, you know, in infancy, for example. And some of those, now they've got corrective surgeries. If you're interested in cardiology, really quite an interesting field because they try to rectify this. Prenatal care, very important. They can pick up a lot of these problems early on, so they know they have to do surgery as soon as the child's born, for example, so they can really save the death rate has gone down a lot in children with surgeries quickly if they get the prenatal care and checkups ahead of time. So it's really quite interesting. So think about what we just talked about, you know, carrying fluid, transport of molecules, energy, glucose to the tissues too, right? And then byproducts, waste products out. Filtration through the kidneys, that's what we didn't cover before, right? Ion balance. So the circulatory system is very important for ion balance to all your tissues, right? Because that carries away excess sodium, for example, potassium regulation for those cells. Okay, so like we mentioned, open circulatory system is a hemocele. Like your crayfish, it has a hemocele, so that's why it's called hemolymph. It's that open body cavity. But it gets a little confusing because some tests, and if you go online, you can hit physiology, and you can hit test banks, and you can pull up, you know, test banks around the world. And some of those questions they had were a little ambiguous and sometimes wrong, I think, on some of those answers, because they said like a crustacean wouldn't have any capillaries. But that's not right, because they do have capillaries through their gills. But it's not a closed circulatory system. So they do have capillaries through the gill chamber, right? Because that's the gas exchange. But then it ends up coming back and then dumps into the body. So the whole circulatory system is not closed, but there are regions where they have capillary beds. In crabs and crustaceans, they've actually monitored, and they can put in catheters, and they can actually watch the blood flow. They even do imaging on them. They can actually show, like, after a meal, digestion, they get an increase in blood flow to the GI tract. Amazing, right? They can actually shunt blood. There's actually sphincters that can close down arterial beds to increase blood flow to some regions and decrease it to others in the simple organisms like a crayfish, for example. So they can regulate their blood flow just like you can regulate your blood flow as well, depending on the need. But you don't cognitively do it. It's all pretty much autonomic, right? So think about this, too, with capillaries. In some open circulatory systems, you do have capillary beds, like in the gills of a crayfish, for example. Okay. And so it's really quite interesting because you get quite a variation from, if you look at it on a comparative aspect, you can see in some annelids, like in the bottom, they have these interesting circulatory systems that can have multiple parts that can pump and keep blood flowing. In like leeches, for example, blood can flow one direction and then reverse and flow back the other direction. So it goes back and forth in their blood tube that they have. And so that's kind of interesting too. So some animals have multiple hearts, and that keeps the blood circulating. And it can actually reverse the flow, so it doesn't always go one direction. This one shows it going one direction, but in some animals it can go one way, reverse, go back the other way. Quite amazing. So earthworms, if you cut open an earthworm on a rainy day, maybe it's too cold today, but in the summer when it rains, you see the earthworms come out of the ground, right? You could always pick one up, dissect it if you're interested, and you'll see red blood inside that animal. If you dissect it really carefully along the back, you'll see that heart tube beat. And then you'll see it beat one way, you'll see it beat another way, and it actually has red blood. And so it has hemoglobin, like us. When you cut open your crayfish, for example, did you see red blood coming out? Did red blood come out in your hands? No. Because their blood is blue blood. It's royal blood. I'm joking. So blue blood, they have a different respiratory pigment. It's called hemocyanin, and it actually has a copper instead of iron like we have with hemoglobin. And it's actually blue in color when it's oxygenated. And then some animals actually have green blood, and they have a different type of, they have different respiratory pigments in them. So it depends on the animal, and we'll get to that a little bit later when we get into respiratory as well, because that's when we talk about carrying oxygen supplies. Okay, so we got the general idea of open circulatory system and pumps and closed circulatory systems. One thing to think about then, how does an open circulatory system get the blood back into the heart? And so, just like your crayfish or Drosophila or insects, they have these little holes called ostei, and these little holes, it depends on the animal, how many they might have. Even your little fruit fly maggot, for example, the little third instar that you might have used in genetics. I don't know if you, did you use larvae in genetics at all? No, at least the adults. No, just the adults, you didn't open up the larvae. Kind of interesting, they have a little heart tube that beats back and forth, but they have three pairs of ostei. The blood comes in at one region, just like this, and then when it contracts, it closes those ostei and then forces blood down the tube. But these little holes are quite interesting because when it relaxes, blood can go in, and then when it contracts, pushes blood this way, and all those close. In some of these animals, these invertebrates like insects, Drosophila larvae, there is no neural innervation. So how does it beat? Ideas? There's no neural innervation, not like your heart. How does it beat? How does your heart beat? Remember the heart lab? You could cut the nerves, right, and your heart will still beat, right? Question, what if we cut, you're in a relaxed state, and you cut the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves to your heart, would your heart speed up or slow down? Speed up, because you have a vagal suppression generally, right, from your temporal nerve. Okay, so that means it can still beat without the neural innervation. So that means you have, what type of cells do we call those? Pacemaker cells, right? So think about, how do they pace? Maybe you've covered that in some of your writings for that heart lab. How do they pace? That means ion balance, right? Ion, sodium in, calcium in, potassium out, has to regulate that, right? Those ion channels have to open and close at the right time, and pump it out at the right time, and regulate that ionic balance. Well, that's not only in our heart, but think of that works in a Drosophila or a crayfish that are, or not a crayfish, think about this, in some of these insects that are myogenic, means the heart can beat on its own, myogenic. If we think about your crayfish, for example, if you cut the nerves, take away the nerves that are on the heart, it will stop beating. So we call those kind of hearts neurogenic. So if it needs the neural innervation to beat, every time it beats, it might need the neural input. That's a neurogenic heart versus myogenic like us are like a Drosophila larvae. Now, as a Drosophila, for example, becomes an adult, it actually has neural innervation on the heart, but it's still myogenic because you can cut the nerves and it can still beat like our heart. So what's the power of using a Drosophila, like the P.H. Morgan building here, right? Why would anybody use Drosophila to look at human disorders in pacemaker activities? Right? Why do you think? What if that calcium channel had a mutation and the calcium wasn't regulated, right? Or the sodium channel, or the potassium channel? You could mimic that problem in a Drosophila with the power of genetics, and you could actually use gene therapy to see if you could correct that problem, right? Or maybe pharmacological acids. So like Eli Lilly is actually using Drosophila quite a bit for screening medications that potentially could be used in you later on. And they use Drosophila as a first screen pass in a lot of these compounds because those ion channels, like from a plant to you, I mean, a plant, sodium channels, TTX works on a plant sodium channel just like it works in you to block a sodium channel too. So you can understand those structural and the sequence. They can actually find out, is there an analogy with the pharmacology, for example, and then try out very fast and very cheaply screening medications. So kind of emphasizing why you study comparative physiology again. Okay, so we kind of went through that. We used to have fun labs. We used to even do this for high schools. We can't do this anymore because of the blood problems. But sometimes we can. We actually do a blood lab at Sayre High School with Rachel Holsinger's class every once in a while in town. But it's kind of interesting. You used to be able to do this for physiology classes, but it's too complicated with all the rules nowadays with working with blood. But you could take a little pinprick right to your finger. You could take a capillary tube, have the blood go up the capillary tube, put it on a little centrifuge flat that spins it around. You put wax on one side and you spin it on down. And you could then measure the hematocrit. You could put that little glass capillary tube on a little dial, move the dial around until it matched up for the hematocrit, and you could actually then measure your hematocrit. And it was kind of fun to do that. And it really helped quite a bit. So the hematocrit is the percentage of your blood that actually is occupied by cells. And so generally, about 45% for males, 42% for females, but it depends on menses cycle as well. All right, so, and then the plasma is the part above it. And this is what's interesting, too, because it's a lot of organic solutes in there, lipoproteins, and sometimes depends on where you want to look at for clotting factors. So they might take out some of these factors. If you ever donate blood, for example. They might ask if you want to be a plasma donor. And what they do is they take blood out, goes to this machine, spins it down, and then gives you back your RBCs, but they take the plasma out. Why would they take the plasma out? What's the plasma used for? Anybody have an idea?
Therapeutic use. It's got all your antibodies and your infection fighting stuff in it.
Right. So some of it, they will actually let some of these white blood cells come out too, but also blood clotting factors, right? For hemophiliacs, for example, they use plasma, and that helps them for clotting. And a hemophiliac lacks the clotting mechanisms. There's different forms of hemophilia. We'll talk a little bit about that. But that very debilitating disorder, you might have covered that in genetics. Did you cover that hemophilia, the family linkage, right? Females are carriers. Guys get it primarily, right? So it's an interesting aspect to think about. That has appeared on Kaplan exams before, the genetic linkage with hemophilia. So if you're taking any kind of pre-med exam, you might want to look at that again, but your genetics. But anyways, so they might ask you to donate plasma, and then you can donate more often because of the plasma, because they give you back your RBCs. If you donate whole blood, what's the life cycle of a red blood cell in general?
6 weeks.
How many days? We should know that, especially if you're allied health. 120 days, right? So about every 120 days, if you donate blood at the blood center, you will get a phone call. And then they'll say, you're ready to donate again. And so it's kind of, they guilt you into it. Anyways, so it's kind of fun. If you haven't donated, they do come on campus every once in a while. It does help people out. Plasma, they're always pretty short of plasma. And they use the plasma also for looking at other immune responses and for research purposes too, not just for hemophilia, but there's lots of aspects in plasma. They're still trying to isolate and figure out what that might do. But interesting to think about. Okay, so the main points we just covered is that erythrocytes, the hematocrit, the red blood cells, but that includes the white blood cells when you measure hematocrit generally, right? If you donate plasma, they might take out some of that as well. Okay. Really interesting about hemoglobin. We're going to cover more of that when we get to respiratory, but that's your respiratory pigment inside your red blood cells. And it's kind of interesting. Your red blood cells, when they're first formed, but as an adult, they do not have a nuclei in them, right? So they're not synthesizing things, right? But in some animals, they actually have a nuclei in their RBC. So that's not the case for all animals that use red blood cells. Some animals actually have a nuclei inside the RBC as well. So watch out for this. This relates to us, humans or mammals, but in some animals, they actually do have a nuclei. The spleen is really important because somebody wrote an article on that one. Are you here today? Somebody wrote about horses with spleens. No? Yes? Do you remember? Or you don't want to raise your hand or whatever. That was really interesting because they showed that the spleen and these horses that are running, they actually store a lot of red blood cells. And when they were running, that could be the storage that gets mobilized into their blood and actually then increases the red blood cells for oxygenation. So spleen's really important for that. But not only that, it helps get rid of the old erythrocytes and break them down. But it's also a really important aspect for lymphocytes, white blood cells. So you might have heard of people that are born without a spleen, and it's called asplenic, and that can happen, the developmental aspect, but they could be very susceptible to an infection, and actually when they get an infection, they're more susceptible than you or I, and they can have a real big problem with this. That's a real issue. There was a case a couple of years back. I can send you this article because it came out in the AP News. It was actually a faculty member here at UK. Their husband was sick, and they went to. So it's kind of a neat story to think about. Was sick, went to an emergent care down in towards Richmond area, and they thought, oh, he just had the flu, but all right, go back home. But feeling really lethargic. This person's very athletic. Does these half marathons and marathons, bikeathons and triathlons and all this kind of stuff. So he's very good in shape, right? But he was really sick. He'd never been sick, really. And so then he went to this urgent care. They said, oh, it looks like you have a flu bug. Go back home. And so he went back home. And I said, this is kind of crazy. The next morning, woke up, could barely move. Took him to UKER. UKER said, after waiting for a good while, said, it looks like you got a really bad flu. Go back home. So he went back home. Came back the next morning. When he woke up in the next morning, his wife said, you are really sick and there's something wrong with you. I've never seen you where you can barely move. Went back to UKER. She came into the ER, dropped him off at the ER, went to go park her car, came back to the ER. He was already in a coma. 54 days in a coma. 54 days in a coma. What was the cause of this? A little dog bite. That can be really severe, right? A little dog bite. So this was a little dog bite on his leg. And it was because he was out jogging, and a little dog came up to him and bit him on the leg. And he didn't think much about it because it was just a peripheral kind of thing. Cleaned it up, and, you know, not much about it. The wife kept saying, every time they went to the hospital, said, is it related to this dog bite at all? Could it be an infection in the dog bite? No, no, not likely, not likely. Even the UKER on both visits. Both visits. So then they checked it when he was in a coma, almost dying, because only 20% survival rate with this gram-negative bacterial infection that's in dogs, that, and it doesn't hit well with the normal antibiotics. So they were giving him antibiotics because he had septicemia, but the wrong antibiotics wouldn't touch that bacterial infection because what's in the dog's mouth was a different type of bacteria that doesn't get hit by these general antibiotics. So in a coma, lost some toes, lost hearing, almost died. They didn't think he was going to survive. And the wife kept pushing about the dog bite. And it wasn't until infectious disease was called, and then they actually cultured his blood and found out that the bacteria was from this dog. And it had nothing to do with everything else. He was asplenic. All throughout all those cares, they never took the history, never found out that he was asplenic. The wife didn't know. She's not in biology or medicine and health. And so she kept telling him he doesn't have a spleen. They never even worried about it. So she could have turned around and sued the crap out of UK, but she didn't do it. She didn't do it. She actually said instead she wants this as an educational purpose. So she wrote this up. It went to the Louisville Colonel or Louisville Courier. UK didn't publish it. I mean, the Lexington Herald didn't publish it. And then it got picked up on AP News and went to the New York Times, too. So it was really quite interesting, this case study. But what she did is she changed the protocol for septicemia at the UK hospital. And you'd think that was only a couple of years ago. Wow. And training the people in the ICU as well as the ER, dog bites are serious. And they carry this bacteria that's really important to watch out for. And asplenic, they call that the zebra. In the room, the zebra is something that really stands out. So this was a zebra. They should have checked that right away for his ability to fight infection, but they didn't do it. Because he didn't have a spleen, that should have rang bells all around. And it was in his medical file. So there's where the liability could have really come in, because they never followed up on it. So anyways, he's back biking again, jogging. He's back functioning somewhat, but with some hearing aid problems and some lack of toes and other functions. So it's kind of interesting to think about. But you get the idea, your spleen is really important. So there's a take home on the spleen. And dog bites, ooh, they just really get me going. Okay. So that might be related to something what we're going to see in a little while. Okay, so think about what this does. Erythrocytes are really important. What regulates urethra red blood cell production? Erythropoietin, right? Where does it come from? Kidneys and liver, right? So if you have a kidney infection or you have kidney problems or kidney failure, you might be anemic, right? Low red blood cells, you might not be able to get oxygenation. If you have liver problems, cirrhosis of the liver, you might be anemic as well because you're not making erythropoietin. So really kind of interesting to think about. What does erythropoietin do? Goes to your long bones and helps to make red blood cells. And so like your ribs or your long bones have that. If you have a car accident, for example, and you crushed your ribs and they're damaged and they're bruised, you might have anemia problems later on. So they might wonder, why are they checking my red blood cell? Why are they checking my hematocrit after that injury? You know, whether I cracked my ribs, for example. Well, there might be a problem in actually making red blood cells. So this is why this is checked up. It's really quite interesting to put it all together. Okay, leukocytes, generally we call those white blood cells to help with the immune system, and platelets for blood clotting. Okay, So this is too in-depth. I don't want you to memorize all these different cells. But the one point I want you to remember is that you have this kind of stem cell, this pluripotent stem cell, that then can make all these different cells in your blood. Isn't that amazing? It's really quite cool. They can make platelets, granulocytes, erythrocytes, red blood cells, macrophages, and lymphocytes, white blood cells. And how that cascade works can be defective in some people, and you have a problem where you don't make the right, say, white blood cells, for example, and you might make more of the other. But the regulation is really quite interesting when you think about erythropoietin here and other hormones, other factors that are made. But really an interesting aspect, and you might, if you take immunology, you might cover more about the different types of lymphocytes and macrophages. But that you have the stem cell, the idea of stem cells, right, for people with leukemia and other aspects is really important because that can help solve some problems. So don't try to memorize all these different things, but just remember you have the stem cell that can make a number of different cell types, and it's under regulation of compounds like erythropoietin. Okay. So clotting factors. I don't want you to memorize all these clotting factors. Some old quizzes might have that on there, but it's really too much. The main point is this point right down here I want to talk about, because this also appears on standardized exams. And this is the important part. Thrombin converts fibrinogen to fibrin. And fibrin is that network that forms the clot. But fibrin will break down in time. You're making clots all the time. You walk around, you hit your leg on the side of the chair, you probably damage blood vessels right there. To avoid that leaking out to your muscle, you form a clot, and then it's broken down. And that's going on all the time in you, all the time, 24/7. That's probably happening. Unless you're a hemophiliac, and that little bruise could end up in a lot of blood loss around that tissue, and they get bruises all the time. But they have to watch out for this. Okay, so what do we have to know? That you have these pathways, and that, like we just talked about down here, thrombin converting fibrinogen to fibrin, that helps this clot, and then you can dissolve that clot. There's different types of forms of hemophilia, but I just want you to realize hemophilia, then you could lack one of these processes. And there's different types of hemophilia, but if you lack these particular cascades or ability to convert, then you could have these different forms of hemophilia. And some people then have to get plasma all the time. And there's other forms of hemophilia where they have to get particular factors injected into them. Otherwise, they might not survive. So it's really quite interesting. If you wanted to follow more on that, you can do that. But the main points we've talked about was down here at the end of the clotting mechanism, okay? So don't get too crazy. But just try to remember that thrombin is really amazing. It does quite a bit. But the main point is down here at the bottom of breaking down are forming the clot by fibrinogen to fibrin. And then you have this clot, and then that slowly will start to degrade. So that's a little bit later. You've probably heard of TPA. If somebody has a clot in their brain, right? They're moving around, they get a clot in their brain. If within 4 to 6 hours, if they end up in the ER, they can get a TPA injection, and that will help dissolve the clot. But what if it wasn't a clot that blocked the brain? Right, and you're not getting blood supply to the brain, they lost your, you know, movement of your right whole side of your body. You can kind of know, oh, there's a problem over here, right, on the left-hand side. Was it a clot, or was it an aneurysm? An aneurysm is busting of the blood vessel. So you sure don't want to get TPA if somebody had an aneurysm, right? They busted that blood vessel. So they got to quickly find out, was it a clot, or was it an aneurysm, because it's going to be different. But then within, it used to be 4 hours, now I think they can go up to 6 hours, and maybe even longer, depending on the clot formation. So it's kind of interesting. Women have more clots than men. They've actually just listened to a dissertation yesterday by a student in nursing, got her PhD in nursing, and she actually worked with Justin Frazier, the neurosurgeon here, and they actually measure blood on before the clot and after the clot, when he removes the clot, to try to find out what happens to the brain when they remove these clots. Quite interesting. Women supposedly actually have more of these problems than men. Interesting case, and it's more of a prevalence in Appalachia than it is in maybe central Kentucky. Okay, right there we have to stop for this quiz, this wonderful quiz that you're going to take. I think last time I started there, and you guys were the last ones that got it. So let's put up your notes, tattoos, and all that good stuff on your arms. Remember to write your name on this first. Try not to cheat. That would be great. I think you'll have fun. Remember, there's a couple pages here. The one reading essay is supposed to be kind of fun to think about. Relates to lots of things. I'll come over there in a minute. You can do all this in no time. The multiple choice questions are straightforward. The essay questions, open response questions, getting you to think about what's going to happen on the test day, remember lots of open response. You don't want to see any blanks.